Welcome into today's edition of Strategies for Living. I'm marriage and family therapist David McMillan. Delighted that you've tuned in, joined with me today here on Strategies. You know, Strategies for Living, we're all about helping us live healthier, happier, and more peaceful lives in our bodies, in our minds, in our spirits, in our relationships here in the 21st century. And we do that by engaging in important conversations with folks we like to call life strategists each and every time we do Strategies for Living. I will be very frank and honest with you. I have been looking forward to today's program.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better.
I was sent a copy of a book called If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away. Bruce Farrell Rosen is the author, and quite honestly, when I opened the package, publicity person that sent it to me, I really like her and I trust her, and when I opened the book, she had told me over the phone, she said, "Have you read Eat, Pray, Love?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I loved it." And she said, "Well, this is a little like that." And so I was intrigued from the beginning. I opened the package. It's a pretty long book. So I said, I took it home, and I started to read it. And I got to tell you, folks, it was hard for me to put down. Bruce Farrell Rosen has caused me to lose some sleep. And that's about the highest compliment that I can pay him. He is actually an investment officer at a major financial firm by day and a writer by night. He's an award-winning writer. He's been that as early as high school. He's written professionally for over three decades. He's been featured in the San Francisco Chronicle and the Examiner. And in addition to a stint as a journalist in Chinatown, he's crafted essays on sports and politics, economics and music. The piece that he actually wrote on his boyhood idol, Sandy Koufax, got to the Baseball Hall of Fame. Dadgum, Bruce, I cannot give you a better introduction than that.
that's nice. I appreciate that. I also love the song you opened with. It's maybe my favorite. If you ask me to list my top ten, it's probably my number one.
Wow. Well, I'm glad, you know, maybe your mom is kind of being a link here, because as I was looking for music last evening, I was, of course, in the back of your book, you've got some lyric credits, because obviously music has been a big part of your life, the Beatles in particularly, John Lennon in particular, and you talk about him in the book and how his music affected you, as it has all of us. And as I flip through, you know, In My Life is not on the first page, second page, third. But it's funny. It jumped out at me as I was flipping through. I said, okay, well, now what music am I going to use here? And In My Life is listed about the fourth page into the credits. But it's almost like it jumped off the page at me.
Thank you for using that. I just incredibly reflective way to begin.
I mentioned Eat, Pray, Love, and the book, your book, has been compared to Eat, Pray, Love. In fact, you call yourself a tour guide on this journey of what it means to be alive. Say a little more about that.
In comparison to Eat, Pray, Love, or just in terms of being a tour guide?
Both.
Well, I think Eat, Pray, and Love is a journey that a woman takes, and she goes through on a journey of trying to discover herself and trying to enjoy herself and entertain herself, but at the same time discover what she has perhaps overlooked in her life and suppressed in her life, and in the end she gives up love, marriage, and she gets divorced and then goes on and goes on a journey the likes of which she couldn't predict, and
right.
in the end experiences some unforeseen events, some very challenging and some very powerful and some superficial and certainly some that at the end give her love. And I think in many ways, although my book is a totally different story, obviously, and I'm a man and my journeys are different and the path is obviously different and the pursuits are different, there is that thread, that common thread. My marriage, which came to an end, sadly, although we remain deeply good friends, and when I have two sons, and when they come home, they're living in New York now. We're a family again, and that was you know a hard and painful separation, especially since we loved each other and continue to love each other, and love each other. Even though we're not in a marriage anymore,
right.
we'll always be soulmates. I'm not so sure that occurred in the Eat, Pray, Love, but that is what has affected you know, my life. But that severance put me on a journey that is you know a journey, as you've read in the book, many, many things, many realizations and experiences and many observations.
Do you remember, Bruce, when you said, this has got to be a book, I've got to write this? Was there a particular inspiration? Was there a particular moment, or did it kind of evolve?
I think it's a very good question. I think it evolved. When I was young, even as a kid, I knew one day I just had this. I knew that I would write that I had a book in me that had to be written. Even when I was a young kid, I knew there was a book in me that had to be written at some point in my life. And as I grew up and became an adult and raised family and got into the investment world, I remained a writer. I continued to write. I did writing for the BBC, a number of radio programs. They called it Diary of a Creative Banker. Fun thing. It actually came about briefly when late Princess Diana died, and I wrote a piece about her, and the BBC called me, and I sent it to the BBC, and they wanted to read it on the air, and I thought that was fantastic. And,
wow.
And they came back to me and said, do you want to do a series? Let's try a series, you know, of observations, and they called it Diary of a Creative Banker. But anyway, that was kind of the writing instinct I had all my life, but so I think it evolved, but then I recognized that when I became separated and I moved into my own apartment, boys were off at college, and that existential realization that your life has changed radically, and really the loneliness and all of these feelings that, you know, that many of us, you know, can relate to, of being alone away from your partner for the first time and wondering where your life is going and realizing that you have freedom if you want it, that was the catalyst. I didn't want to waste that time.
Right.
I didn't know if we'd get back together. I didn't know where it was going. Could have been we'd get back together in 6 months, a year, whatever. We didn't, but I didn't want to waste that time. I knew that was the time.
That loneliness that you're talking of, it almost seemed to me in reading your account of your life prior to the separation with Sue, you were still feeling lonely, and you make it very clear through no fault of hers.
Exactly.
But there was, it seemed to me that I read between the lines that that loneliness was there then too. Did I interpret that right?
That's a fantastic observation, really. You're obviously very good at what you do, David. Yes, I would say, I would say absolutely. And I don't think it was there all of my marriage, but I think it was there the more we became platonic friends rather than, raising children requires everything. And if you want to if you want to do a great job and raise your children to be loving, nurtured people, I think we did a great job of that together. And they are that way, and they are fantastic young men now, and creative, and loved, and loving. And they grew up in a family of love. As I say, that still exists. But I think along the way, if we tend to fall into these patterns or these roles in which certainly the romance disappears, but you become comfortable.
Yes.
But the romance disappears, and the love isn't gone, but it keeps getting buried under all of the obligations of life. And
takes a lot of energy.
Teenagers.
Takes a tremendous amount of energy to raise your children the way that you're describing that the two of you raised your boys.
I think that when my mom passed away, and as you know, I mean, she plays a very important role in my book. I mean, the title of the book, If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away, are the words she gave me as she was passing away. But when my mom passed away, and we had a deep, I mean, she was an incredible human being, number one as a mother, number two as a healer, as a mentor, as a guide, you know, in many different ways. And she was so down to earth, and I missed her so deeply, I mean, every day. But when she passed away, and I'm the eldest son, and I had shared much of her pain growing, you know, as kids growing up, we had a tough father. When she passed away, I think I poured myself into my work after I grieved, and I poured myself into my family and my kids, but I went to a quiet place within my soul, my spirit, at the end of every day that my wife couldn't reach me. She couldn't find me in that place, and I didn't disappear, but I went to a place where, for solace, that I think had an effect on our marriage eventually.
Yes. When we come back from our break, I want to spend a little time talking about your mom. Can we do that?
Love to.
If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away. This is a special book. Now, you can go to almarosepublishing.com. That's Bruce's website. And we'll say more about how you can get a copy of the book. But you got to get a copy of this very special book out from Bruce Farrell Rosen. If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away. Bruce Rosen, our life strategist today, here on Strategies for Living. We're coming back. Stay with us.
Son, you're a young man now. I just wanted to take a few minutes and talk about, well, about men and women.
I know all about that stuff.
Well, you might know a little biology, but do you know how to treat a woman?
I guess I could use a little direction. So how do I treat a woman, Dad?
I'm not going to tell you. You have to figure that out by yourself.
How?
Well, first I suggest you watch a lot of bad TV and violent movies and observe how women get treated there.
Okay. I'm kind of doing that already. What else?
Well, let's see. Oh, yeah. When you're at school, be sure to take careful note of what irresponsible older boys say.
I sure will.
Sometimes the only message boys get is the wrong one. Many young men need advice and direction on how to behave towards women. You can help provide it. By teaching boys early that violence against women is wrong, you can help prevent domestic violence. For tips on what to say, visit www.endabuse.org. end abuse. Teach early. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council and the Family Violence Prevention Fund.
Into Strategies for Living. I'm marriage and family therapist David McMillan with Bruce Farrell Rosen today. The book is If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away. It's out from Alma Rose Publishing, and you can find Bruce online. His website is almarosepublishing.com. You can order the book directly from the website. Bruce, is it also available at all of the places we get books these days, Amazon?
Yes, it is. It's on almarosepublishing.com. It's also on all the e-readers, the Nook and the Kindle. It's on Amazon and all the, you know, all the basic places.
All the places you can find books these days. Now, there's a beautiful, your mom is a beautiful lady, was a beautiful lady. There's a picture early in the book, a couple of pictures of Alma Rose, a couple of striking ones, one with, I guess, your dad on the beach when he was claiming his prize.
Yeah, when we first moved to California from Canada.
So introduce us to Alma Rose. She obviously a very special lady.
Yes, Alma Rush was her maiden name, and my father, Rosen. But the name Alma Rose is the name, well, she used the name Rose. She was a psychic, among many things, a great mom and all the other wonderful things. She was an incredible psychic and healer, and
She actually read tea leaves, right?
She read tea leaves, and she read tea leaves for the rich and famous, like Marlon Brando, and she read and Johnny Rivers, and just a lot of the top people.
Wow.
That found out about her and flew in from Europe and came in from Hollywood. She lived in Southern California, and she read tea leaves for the very poor and indigent and couldn't afford a reading even, but needed help and would come to her for guidance. And she discovered her gift when she was quite young. She was born and raised in Toronto, Canada, grew up during the Depression. Her mother believed in psychics and would go down the street in Toronto to a couple of English ladies that were psychic. And one day, she decided to take her young daughter with her, Alma. And this story's in the book, really in the book, I think. She went to these psychic ladies, and she asked these psychic ladies a question. And the ladies recognized right away that her daughter, my mom, was incredibly psychic. And when my grandmother asked these ladies the question, this is the way my mom told it, she said, I'm not going to answer. One of the ladies, English ladies, said, I'm not going to answer that question. I want you to ask your daughter for the answer to that question. And my mom, my grandmother was astonished and said, okay. And asked my mom that question. My mom answered the question, something that, a little kid, she must have been 8, could not possibly know, and astonished my mom, astonished my grandmother. And at that moment, it was clear that she had this very psychic daughter. Not long after that, her father, my grandfather, who had some apartment buildings, I guess, or in Toronto, an apartment building, was going out to collect rent one night, and my mom wanted to go with her father and said, Pa, I want to go with you. And he said, no, you stay home, you know, stay home. And she said, no, I want to go with you. And he was a tough man, and if anybody crossed him, he would certainly not be happy about it. But this time he gave in and relented, and she went, and it was dark. And the way my mom told the story was they went down some dark alley, and he was getting out to go collect a rent. And as just before he opened the door of the car, she said, Pa, she screamed, don't open it. A man is going to try to kill you. And he begins to open the door, and a man comes at him with a crowbar. You know, couldn't be seen, come from behind a something. And he shuts the door fast, and from that moment on, the father believed it. After that, she went. She would visit these English ladies that her mother would visit, and they taught her how to read tea leaves. They taught her how to channel her gift into seeing images and pictures in a teacup. And she became unbelievable at it, and so much so that her mother said, Alma, that's it. You're scaring people. You can't do that anymore. I mean, you can do it, but you have to do it within the family. You can't do it for anybody else.
Right, right.
So fast forward quite a bit, and when I'm 16 years old, my father leaves, and she has to rely on her gift to raise a family. There are four of us. I'm the oldest. My one brother was 15. Another would have been 12, and my sister would have been 10. My father left, and she had to raise, you know, four kids.
Yeah.
And she did it through her gift. Prior to that, she continued to do it, but sort of as a hobby, maybe for a couple extra dollars along the way during the time she was married. But she had to rely on that gift to raise us, and it's amazing the stories that she told people, and I'm in touch with some of those people today that miss her deeply, have gone to other spiritualists and guides, and have never found anybody even close to her in terms of what she gave them, in terms of readings and love and compassion, wisdom, truth. So she's an incredible woman. Incredible woman.
We were kind of chuckling earlier at the song choice. Do you think that and feel her influence in your life still today, Bruce?
Oh, absolutely. So true. My mom has a scent. Had a scent. Almost like a combination of tobacco. I mean, she smoked, but it wasn't almost a tobacco scent to her, a perfume scent, a tobacco scent, a soulful scent.
Hmm.
You know, it's really funny. I was in England once, and I, long ago, I don't know, 12 years ago, and I tasted some tea. They didn't have the tea here in the United States at that time. Not long after that, they started exporting it to the United States, but once I tasted it, it was shortly after my mom passed away. I'd asked the person at the hotel, where can I get this tea? Because the taste tasted or smelled like my mom.
Wow.
And they told me where to go get it. And it was at Harrods in the basement pantry. And I came back to the States. I ordered a whole bunch of boxes of it. And came back to the States, and they didn't have it anywhere. But a year or two later, they did get it. And it's it's that South African red tea called Rooibos tea, R-O-O-B-O-I-S, I think they spell it. And it's this natural tea, it's naturally decaffeinated, and it has this incredible scent, and it's rich in antioxidants. And ever since, I mean, I drink that tea, whenever I taste it, it reminds me of my mom's presence and her scent. But yes, the answer is often. Sometimes there'll be periods of time when I don't sense her and I wonder where she is, and then I will sense her really strongly. I'll tell this story quickly, not too quickly, but that you'll probably remember from the book. And right after my mom passed away, and I was grieving and deeply. And I went for a walk. I live in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And I went for a walk around the neighborhood. My boys both went to a school up the street from this park. And I had taken a week or two off to grieve. And I went for a walk that day. And I sat in the park, and I decided to get up and walk again. And I went over to the other side of the park, just down the street from where my boys would be getting out of school. And it was around the time that they would be getting out of school, and I was hopeful that I would catch them walking down that street home, and I'd walk home with them. And I sat on this the wall above the street, the sidewalk, and I went into a very deep sadness and grief, and I had started crying deeply, sobbing, and I asked the question out loud, and I said, "Mom, you always said that if I ever needed you, you won't be far away, and you said it when you were dying," and I said, "I just need a sign. I need some kind of sign that you're there." So I get up from the fence, and I start walking. I don't see the boys, so I start walking home. And literally within 10 or 15 seconds, I see and I've never seen my mom's. It's not the most common name in the world. I've never seen her name on a license plate or on anything before.
Right.
I don't think I'd ever seen my mom's name spelled out on anything. And I look up, I start walking, and I say it's like 20 seconds later, and there's this license plate in front of me, and it says Elma, the way she spells it, A-L-M-A, loves, L-O-V-E-S, 10. And, I mean, I could go into deep, I could start crying right now talking about it. Mm. I go into Elma loves 10. My God. What does that, I mean, how unbelievable. And I started counting, well, it was enough just to see Elma loves 10, but then I started counting who are the people that she really, really deeply loves in her life. And I swear to God, I couldn't count less or more than 10.
Wow. I've got goosebumps. And I, as I had when I read the story in the book, and that's what I want people to understand, that this book is crafted and packed with those kinds of stories interspersed. This is not just a book about your life. This is in many ways a book about all of us. And you said earlier, you know, you knew you had a book in you, and I want to talk to people, because I know one of the things that you do in your craft is inspiring others. I want to come back and let's talk a little bit about that. Can we do that? Incredible, incredible book. It's called If You Ever Need Me. If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away. Bruce Farrell Rosen, our life strategist today, here on Strategies for Living. We'll be back.
Then we wouldn't have to wait so long. And wouldn't it be nice to live together in the kind of world where we belong? No, it's gonna make it that much better when we can say goodnight and stay together.
Hello, can I ask a few questions about the apartment you have on Park Street?
What was your name?
My name is Juan Hernandez.
It's been rented.
Oh, it's gone?
Hello?
Hello, my name is Sanjay Kumar. I am calling about the apartment on Park Street.
It's not available.
It's not available, but I just now saw it in the paper.
May I help you?
Hi, my name is Tyrone Washington. I'm calling about a place to rent on Park Street.
No longer available.
It's not available now.
Nope, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Yes, hello. My name is Graham Wellington. I'm calling about the apartment for rent on Park Street. Is that still available?
Yes, it is.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Oh, really? I'd love to make an appointment.
Housing discrimination is illegal. If you think you've been a victim because of your race, color, national origin, sex, religion, disability, or family status, call 800-669-9777 or visit fairhousinglaw.org. Fair housing. It's not an option. It's the law. Brought to you by HUD, the Ad Council, and LCCREF.
Therapist David McMillan with Bruce Farrell Rosen. I don't know if you became a honky-tonk man, but you did have to kind of step out of the box in order to get this book written, in a sense.
Definitely.
And that story is wrapped up in this book, too. We'll get to that, but I want to come back to what we were mentioning right before the break, Bruce. Let me first tell people, and again remind people, if you've just tuned in, Bruce Farrell Rosen is our guest today. He's our life strategist. He's the author of a book you need to read. It's called If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away. And you can find the book at all your favorite booksellers. You can download it to your Nook or to your Kindle or wherever you, however you read books electronically. You can go to almarosepublishing.com. That's Bruce's website. And order the book. Lots of ways to get If You Ever Need Me, I Won't Be Far Away, Bruce Farrell Rosen. How did you get so good at the craft of this craft of writing? And I know you want to help others also. You know, there's probably some people listening to us right now who can relate to I have a book in me.
First of all, I want to say that my heart goes out to you, David, for the music you're playing.
Thank you.
On this show. I mean, it's the soundtrack from my book, and it's very touching to hear it.
Thank you.
Each song brings back memories. Probably about 50 songs in the book that we obtained the rights to use, and just really, really sweet to hear it. How did I get good? I always felt that I was a writer. I always felt that I was born to write, really. And I always wanted to touch people. Through my work, you know, or whatever I would do, I always felt the need to express myself.
Yes.
And I think that my mom, who was a very expressive human being, had a big effect on my development in terms of being an expressive young man growing up and sharing feelings. And very early on in school, teachers recognized that I had the ability to write, and there's so many people out there that have the ability to write, they don't even realize it, and oftentimes you don't have somebody telling you that you're a good writer, but believe in yourself is the message I want to give. I mean, if you think that you have a story to tell and you want to tell it, and you're passionate about telling it. I think to be a writer, you have to have the passion. It can't just be blasé.
Yeah.
It has to be a passion to say something, to say it and to say it in the best possible way that you can. First, tell it to yourself, and then work on it and try to tell it in the best possible way and in the most honest, especially if it's an autobiography or a memoir or a piece about yourself or a poem or whatever it may be. We have so much in us, all of us, so many different talents, and I think so many people can write without recognizing that they can. I recognized it because my mom recognized it. I recognized it because I had a teacher once when I was young that said, Bruce, this is really a good story. I'd like to see you keep writing. And when I was about eight, I was a baseball nut. I was sports. I love sports. There's a lot of sports in my book.
Yes, there is.
You know, and baseball, you know, is a big part of sports nut. So is hockey and other things. But when I was about 8 years old, I wrote a book, not a book. I wrote a story book. I wrote a story that I thought when I was eight I would make. I thought it would be a book. I sat down one day to write it, to write this story called. The day the Mets were a new team, and they were terrible.
Right.
And I wrote a story called The Day the Mets Won the Pennant, or the World Series, I can't remember. And I knew all the, and the Mets were horrible. I mean, they lost 120 games or something that season. Whatever. And I knew the players of the Mets, and I was a big Dodgers fan. I idolized Sandy Koufax. And I wrote this story that when I sat down at 8 years old, I thought, I'm going to write a book. Well, it turned out to be a short story that I read to the class. And the teacher just loved it. And I gave it to the teacher, and she asked me to read it to the class. And I recognized, I think, then that this is really what I wanted to do. And I wound up keeping that dream alive through the other work I do in the, you know, in the investment world by day. As I got older and didn't want to let that go. But I would also say that here's a story that when I was in high school, I was about 16 years old, and my father had left, and I was rebellious, and it was a time of, you know, it was like early 1970, 71, and drugs and marijuana and everything was in the air, and I wound up being very rebellious. I tell a story in the book about hopping freight trains across the country. And I wound up sort of deciding I was just going to drop out of school. Or I wasn't going to try very hard.
Yeah.
And I just, a tough dad, and I just had that. You're 16 and you're rebellious. And a teacher called me after school once and said, Bruce, you know, you're failing this class. And unless you pass this class, you're not going to, you're going to have to make it up or you won't graduate. She says, I want you to make it up by doing this extra credit assignment. Because I wasn't doing any of the assignments. And she gave me something to write. And so just this example of how a teacher can turn a person around, how important, if you're teachers out there, I mean, what an incredible job you do. Not often appreciated enough. But this teacher took an interest in me and said, you're going to fail this class, and I want you to do this assignment, and here's this writing thing. And I thought, well, okay, I better do it.
Yeah.
And so I wrote this piece, and she asked me to write, and I came back and gave it to her, and she called me after class a couple days later and said, you know, Bruce, you're a very creative and talented writer and one of the best writers I've ever had in my classes. And she said, and you've got the battle half won. She says, the other half is just wanting to. Hmm. Wanting to make something of yourself. And wow, you know?
Yeah.
That conversation turned it around for me.
Hmm. you know, we touched on this earlier, Bruce. There's a lot in this book, and this is not just, I mean, you know, we opened the program by mentioning Eat, Pray, Love, and I loved Eat, Pray, Love, but I don't think people would look at that and say that's a man's book.
Right.
You know, I think that most people would say, I'm putting this in quotations now, that's a female book, that's a woman's book.
Right.
But your book, as you mentioned, as we mentioned together, has some aspects of Eat, Pray, Love, but there's a little bit of everything in here. There's sports for us guys. There's music for us baby boomers. But there's politics. There's spirituality. It's interesting. You wrote the book obviously in the time that we were getting into the big financial crisis that we're still in.
Right.
And so there's a little bit of everything in here. And even you write about being a you were Bruce Wong. You were
yes.
You did a stint at a Chinese newspaper.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I did when I first moved to San Francisco.
All of these things coalesce together and play a part in this book. And those things, when you look at them, they don't seem to be melded together, but you do such a wonderful job of it. Can you have any explanation for that?
For how it all comes together?
Yeah, for how all of that comes together.
I was having a conversation with a friend last night, and we're talking about writing, and we were talking about. I was saying that that there's so many things. You know, first of all, nonfiction, telling a person's story, can be more captivating than any fiction because it's real.
Yes.
You know, because it's you.
Yeah.
And there's so many things that we sort of toss out about ourselves that we disregard and think it's not important, or we think other people aren't going to be interested in it. Think it's unnecessary or immaterial or whatever. I mean, we discard it. We edit it out of our lives. And when you write, especially if you're writing about yourself, you want to write about. You want to try to remember all of the things and all the little details and all the little items of your life that when you actually expose them to the light of day are important. And I think that in remembering these details, and certainly it helps to try to be conscious as you're living and live deeply and live consciously and live emotionally, you know, and live passionately. But as you remember these details, they lead to so many more details.
Yes. You know,
So when I wrote this book, I knew that there were a number of themes or things that areas of my life I wanted to cover. And yet I knew they were interconnected sequentially.
Hmm.
But also through the thread of the fabric of my being, I mean, my life, they were all connected. And they were connected even as the music is connected.
Yes.
And one song leads to another song. So it all came together naturally through trying to be true to myself, true to the memory of who I was, and try to be true to the person I am, and to relive the music of my era and my time and my life, and to remember who I was and who I am.
And remember the games. Remember, the,
remember
games.
The games.
Remember the games you saw.
Hmm. Pardon?
Remember all of the games you witnessed and saw.
Hmm. Exactly. Hmm. And remember the people.
Yeah. See, that's one. That's one thing that I got. Even though I don't think you said it this way or mentioned it, my sense is that this would have been an important work for the planet, even if you hadn't published it.
An important work? I didn't hear that.
It would have been an important work for the planet, even if you hadn't published it, because, in a sense, you are sharing your journaling with us. And in a sense, what you're doing is encouraging other people to journal.
Exactly.
And to be more conscious. Not everybody will publish theirs, but again, my sense is that even if you hadn't published yours, it would have been important for the planet. If it's a long book, I mentioned that, but if there were one message, Bruce, that you wanted after people read the 650 pages, if there were one message that you would want them to have, that you would want them to come away with, what would that be?
Well, maybe there's one or a couple of them. One, I think, would be a lot of people feel like they're drowning out there. Or it's hard, and life is hard. And as you remember from the story about almost drowning in the Colorado River.
Right.
I asked for help, and I got help.
Yes.
So one, and I made it. And so one message is, don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to connect with your friends or to go out and get help from people out there that can help you, and including people like David McMillan.
Thank you, Bruce.
And to not be afraid to ask for help, and to don't feel that you have to be so macho and strong that you can't, let go. That's one message. I think another message is we often live with regret and guilt and wishing we could have done something a different way, or should we have done what we did, and was it a mistake? Live in regret and guilt, and it affects our health and our life and our happiness and our futures and everybody around us. And I think we have to recognize that, again, if we're conscious and we're doing our best, let go of that regret and guilt. It's important to use it a little bit to think about trying to make better decisions in the future, but let it go.
But don't hold on to it.
Don't hold on to it.
For me, this is a book about joy and love.
Right.
And that's the bottom line. And I just appreciate your sharing it with us. And I appreciate you sharing your time today. Thank you, Bruce Farrell Rosen.
David, thank you for a beautiful experience talking with you, and the opportunity to offer these thoughts, and for the music that you've put into the soundtrack of this interview. It's a really great experience to do it.
My pleasure. If you ever need me, I won't be far away. It's Bruce Farrell Rosen, and you can find him at almarosepublishing.com. If today were the last day of your life, you only had one more phone call that you could make, who would you call? What would you say? And why are you waiting? Make the call. For Bruce Farrell Rosen, I'm marriage and family therapist David McMillan. I'll see you next time on Strategies for Living.
Love is real. Real is love. Love is feeling.